content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today, from the January 7th, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine, I'll read a poem by Heather Crystal, a short story by David Sedaris, and an essay about philosopher Elizabeth Anderson, who wants us to rethink the basis of a free and democratic society. As usual, I'll begin with a poem. This one is entitled Advent by Heather Crystal. It's hopeless. The stars, the books about stars, they can't help themselves. And how could you not love them for it here in the new week with animals burying food and everything outlined in cold and even friends? It's hopeless, this mess, this season. All that is lost and tickets and strangers, what can I say? Only sitting here on this dark bench waiting for what I don't know. I want this world to remain with me, this holy tumult, which does not know it loves me. And you, friends, spectacular driveways and orange, the vanishing year. And now, from the personal history section, a story entitled Father Time, Life at Every Age by David Sedaris. The night before his 95th birthday party, my father fell while turning around in his kitchen. My sister Lisa and her husband Bob dropped by hours later to hook up his new TV and discovered him on the floor, disoriented and in pain. He fell again after they righted him, so an ambulance was called. At the hospital, they met up with our sister Gretchen and with Amy, who had just flown in from New York to attend the party, which was now canceled. "It was really weird," she said, when we spoke on the phone the following morning. "Dad thought Lisa was Mom, and when the doctor asked him where he was, he answered, 'Syracuse, where he went to college.' And then he got mad and said, 'You're sure asking me a lot of questions,' as if that's not normal for a doctor. I think he thought this was just some guy he was talking to." Fortunately, he was lucid again by the following afternoon. That was the hard part for everyone, seeing him so confused. On the night that my father fell, I was in Princeton, the fourth of 80 cities I would be traveling to for work. On the morning he was moved from the hospital to a rehabilitation center, I was on my way to Ann Arbor. Over the next week, he had a few little strokes, the sort people don't notice right away. One affected his peripheral vision, and another his short-term memory. He'd wanted to return home after leaving rehab, but by this point there was no way he could continue to live alone. I wrote him a letter saying in part, "It isn't safe for you at the house anymore, at least not on your own, and this concerns me. I need you to live long enough to see Donald Trump impeached." We fought bitterly after the election, and I knew it would be just my luck. My father would die, and the very next day the president would go down, denying me a well-deserved opportunity to gloat. I'm not sure where I was when my father moved into his retirement home. Springmore, it's called. I saw it finally 4 months after his fall when Hugh and I flew to North Carolina. It was early August, and we arrived to find him in an easy chair, blood flowing from his ear at what seemed to me like a pretty alarming rate. It looked fake, like beet juice, and it was being dabbed at by a nurse's assistant. "Oh, hello," my father said, his voice soft and weary sounding. I thought he didn't know who I was, but then he added my name and held out his hand, David. He looked behind me, Hugh. Someone had wrapped his head with gauze, and when he leaned back, he resembled the late English poet Edith Sitwell. Very distinguished-looking, almost imperious. His eyebrows were thin and barely perceptible. It was the same with his lashes. I guess that, like the hairs in his arms and legs, they just got tired of holding on. "So what happened?" I asked, though I already knew. Lisa had told me that morning on the phone that his grandfather clock had fallen on him. It was made of walnut and bronze and had an abstract human face on it, surrounded by numbers that were tilted at odd angles. My mother always referred to it as Mr. Creech, after the artist who made it, but my dad calls it Father Time. I'd said to Hugh after hanging up with Lisa, "When you're 95 and Father Time literally knocks you to the ground, don't you think he's maybe trying to tell you something?" "Well, he insisted on moving it himself," the woman attempting to staunch the bleeding said, "and it cut his ear. We sent him to the hospital for stitches, but now it's started up again. Maybe because he's on blood thinner, so we've called an ambulance." And she raised her voice, even though my father is not hard of hearing. "Haven't we, Lou? Haven't we called an ambulance?" At that moment, two EMT workers came in, both young and bearded, like lumberjacks. Each took an elbow and helped my father to stand. Are we going somewhere?" he asked. "Back to the hospital," the woman shouted. "All right," my father said, "okay." And they wheeled him out, and the woman explained that while the staff would remove bloodstains from the carpet, it was the family's job to get them off any privately owned furniture. "I can bring you some towels," she suggested. A few moments later, another aide walked into the room. "Excuse me," she said, "but are you the famous son?" "Well, I'm a pretty sorry excuse for famous," I told her, "but yes, I'm his son." "So you're Dave? Dave Chappelle? Can I have your autograph? Actually, can I have two?" Sure, I said. I just joined Hugh in cleaning the easy chair when the woman, who seemed slightly nervous, the way you might be around a world-famous comedian who was young and black and had his whole life ahead of him, returned for two more autographs. "I'm the worst son in the world," I told her, reaching for the scraps of paper she was holding out. "My father fell on April 7th, and this is the first time I've visited, the first time I've talked to him even." "Well, you put yourself down too much," the woman said. "Just pick up the phone every so often. That's what I do with my mother." And she offered a forgiving smile. "You can make that second autograph to my supervisor," and she gave me a name. I couldn't help but think of Mayview, the nursing home my father put his mother in back in the mid-70s. It seemed like only yesterday that I'd gone with him to see her. If now, here I was, visiting him in a similar place, wouldn't it be me, in the blink of an eye, in my own retirement center? Me, the frail widower, reduced to a single room? Only I won't have children to look after me, the way my father has Lisa, who had been extraordinary, and my brother Paul and Amy and Gretchen. My sister-in-law Kathy had outdone everyone, stopping by sometimes twice a day, taking Dad to lunch, rubbing lotion into his feet. I was the only exception. Me, Dave Chappelle. "Do you think we can get a few pictures together?" one of the nurses asked me on my way out. "Oh, wait, I want one too," another woman said. And another after her. "Look," I imagined them telling people afterward, "I got a photo of me with Dave Chappelle." "No, you didn't," they'd be told. Of course, I'd be long gone by then, like always. Hugh and I drove to our house on Emerald Isle, the C-section, after leaving Springmore, and were joined a few days later by his older brother John, who'd brought two boys, his 7-year-old grandson Harrison and Harrison's half-brother Austin, who was 11. All three live in a small town on a strait several hours west of Seattle. The kids had never encountered water they could walk into without shrieking from the cold. They'd never seen fine sand or pelicans. I thought they'd be thrilled, but it was hard luring them away from the portable gaming console they'd brought from Washington, a Nintendo Switch. "What?" Harrison cried, exasperated after touring the house. "You don't have a TV set we can hook this up to?" He was one of those children who'd skipped cute and gone straight to handsome. I suppose this could change over the next few decades. His nose might grow out of proportion to the rest of his face. He could lose his chin or a cheek in some sort of accident. But even then he'd have his eyes, which were cornflower blue, and a pouty, almost feminine mouth, the lower lip slightly larger than the top one. Everywhere we went, he was the best-looking person in the room. Does he realize it? I wondered. Kids his age are usually oblivious. Looks aside, Harrison and his half-brother, both of whom live with their mother, were far from spoiled. The Nintendo was something John had given them. They aren't allowed one at home, and after a few hours, I could understand why. The console was the first thing they'd reach for in the morning and the last thing they'd look at before going to bed, which most nights was well after 1 a.m. The boys didn't seem to have any rules the way I did when I was their age. "You can't just leave the table," I said to Harrison on the first night of his visit, when he finished his dinner and ran off to play Minecraft. "You have to ask if you can be excused." "No, I don't." "No, I don't, Mr. Sedaris." I made the boys call me that and would correct them whenever they slipped up. "I'm an adult and you're guests in my house."
"It's not your house, it's Hugh's," Harrison said.
Hugh looked up from his plate.
"Well, he's right. Look at the deed. This place is in my name."
"Yes, but I bought it," I said. Harrison rolled his eyes. "Yeah, right." The following afternoon, I came down from my desk and found him and his brother on the sofa, gaming again.
"Why don't you put the Nintendo away and write a letter to your mother?" I said.
Harrison nudged Austin in the ribs.
"Stranger danger."
This apparently was something they learned in school.
"Don't talk to him."
"I'm not a stranger. I'm your host, and it wouldn't hurt you to be a little more like me for a change."
"So what's so good about you?" Harrison asked.
"Two things," I said, my mind racing as I tried to think of something. "I'm rich, and I'm famous." He shook his head, eyes locked in his game.
"I don't believe a word you say."
"Hugh," I called, "will you tell Harrison I'm rich and famous?"
"I think he's out on the beach," Austin said, his eyes glued like his half-brother's to the paperback-sized console they were sharing.
"What did you get famous for?"
"I wrote books," I said.
"Well, I never heard of any of them," Harrison told me.
"That's because you're 7, I said, more hurt than I care to admit. "Grown-ups know who I am, especially nurses."
Later that afternoon, for the fourth time that week, Hugh saw someone taking pictures of our house.
"I think they read your last book," he said.
"See?" I shouted to Harrison in the next room. He was into his game and didn't answer. "They're most likely just taking pictures of the C-section sign," I said to Hugh. "It is a pretty good name for a beach house." And I then told him about a place our neighbor Burmy had mentioned that was farther up the coast and was called You Didn't Get This. "That probably gets photographed as well," I said, "especially by divorced men." The picture taking on the street side of our house was nothing compared with what was going on out back. When I was young, sea turtles would lay their eggs on the beach, and no one thought much about it. Now, though, it's a huge deal. Loggerheads are on bumper stickers and signs. They're an attraction like the wild horses near Ocracoke. The spot where the eggs are laid is marked, and when the time arrives for them to hatch, a team of volunteers from the Turtle Patrol is dispatched. A bright yellow stake had been driven into the sand near the foot of the wooden staircase that led from our house to the beach, and the morning after the boys arrived, volunteers dug a trench that would make it easier for the hatchlings to find the ocean. Now it was lined on either side with folding chairs and the Turtle Patrol nest sitting. I said to Hugh, "It's like the red carpet at the Academy Awards." People walking down the beach, seeing the yellow caution tape and the trench watched over by do-gooders in bright Turtle Patrol t-shirts, wandered over to ask questions, and the crowd grew. At night, they'd sit with infrared flashlights, intently staring down, watching for the slightest movement, with their cameras at the ready. "It's actually called a boil," Kathy told me. "That's because when the eggs hatch and the babies claw their way to the surface, the sand actually churns."
"Isn't that exciting?" I said to the boys.
"Uh-huh," they said. "Sure."
"Really?" I said. "You're not interested in nature?"
When I was their age, it was pretty much all I cared about, that and stealing and spying on people. I told them about the hideous-looking silver possum that had climbed up the front stairs of the house last Thanksgiving. "We fed her fruit and leftovers, and you should have seen the way her hands grabbed the food, almost like a human. Every night she came." Austin politely but vacantly said, "Wow." The only way to get the boys' attention was by throwing one of the stink bombs I'd bought a week earlier on Cape Cod. I'd thought the smell would be negligible, maybe like an old sock, but instead it cleared not just the room where the boys were playing Mario Kart, but an entire side of the house.
It was sulfur for the most part. What I imagine Satan's bathroom would smell like after he'd been on the toilet with the National Review for a while. "Ah, damn it," Hugh said, holding his nose and opening the front and back doors, letting the hot, humid air in. "And we have company coming." "Why, you book writer," Harrison scolded. He was wearing Minecraft pajamas and looked like a male model who'd been put into a machine and made small. Of the two brothers, Austin had the sweeter temperament. He'd ask questions and offer to help out. His voice had an old-fashioned quality to it, like a boy's in a radio serial. "Gee willikers," you could imagine him saying, if that were the name of a video game in which things blew up and women got shot in the back of the head. Compared with other kids I've known, the two were actually pretty good. Both liked fish, and they always ate everything on their plates. Rarely did they bicker, and when they did, it was over within a minute or two. There was no crying, and better still, no sulking. That, to me, is unbearable. "Oh, move on, for God's sake," my mother used to say when we glared and stewed, vowing to never forget the injustice of egg salad or potato chips that were from the bottom of the bag and broken. The boys weren't terribly interested in the turtle boil taking place in back of the house, but I thought they might change their mind if they saw the baby loggerheads. The eggs were the size of ping pong balls and were supposed to hatch on Monday, and then Tuesday, and then Wednesday. At night, we'd walk to the top of our stairway and see if there was any action. "Aren't we lucky to have a front row seat?" I'd say. "If you say so," Harrison would answer. My 15-year-old niece, Maddie, had the same attitude. She was at the beach as well, though you'd hardly know it. We'd see her briefly at lunch and dinner, but the rest of her time was spent in seclusion, her face 6 inches from her phone. Was there an equivalent when I was young? I wondered. I don't recall my parents crying, "You and that goddamn transistor radio!" The boys slept in what we'd come to think of as my father's room. It was strange being at the beach without him. But we didn't yet have the proper equipment, a walk-in shower, bars, beside the toilet, and so on. A year earlier, he hadn't needed those things. But that's the difference between 94 and 95. The day before his fall, he'd driven to the gym, not knowing that it was his last time behind the wheel of his car, his last night in his own bed. There would be a lot of that in his immediate future, the last time he could dress himself. The last time he could walk. I worried that he had entered a period when it would be one thing after another, death by a thousand cuts, a fall, a stroke, an accident with a grandfather clock. That's how it was with the other extremely old people I'd known in my life. The woman across the road from us in Normandy, our next-door neighbor in London, Phyllis Diller. Late in her life, the two of us became friends. She lived in a mansion in Brentwood, and each time I'd visit her there, she'd be a little bit less able. Her eyes wouldn't stop watering, or she couldn't get up from a chair without help. Phyllis was lucky in that she could remain at home, hire around-the-clock help. Lucky, too, that she was famous, a legend by any definition. All day, disciples came to pay homage to her, and every night she went out. Thus, she was spared the loneliness so many old people have to suffer. The last time I went to her house, I found her on the back patio. It was 1 in the afternoon, and she was having a martini. "Carla," she called to her assistant, "get David here something to drink. What would you like, sweetie, a vodka?" "Oh, just some water," I said, settling in beside her. "Water with vodka in it?" "No, just the water." "Bring him a vodka tonic," Phyllis instructed, forgetting, I guess, that I don't drink. In Carla's absence, she pointed to 2 pigeons parading across her beautifully landscaped lawn. "All those 2 do," she said, lifting her glass with her blue-veined hand, the fingers as thin and brittle as twigs. "I mean, all they do is make love." We were off somewhere when most of the turtles hatched, some 63 of them. We missed the 6 that clawed their way out the following day as well. Hugh's brother left with the boys on a Sunday, and a few hours later, the final one burst forth. I was on a long walk when it happened, and returned minutes after it had stumbled down the trench and into the ocean. "It was heartbreaking," Hugh reported. He was standing in his bathing suit on the beach behind our house, 1 in a crowd of 50 or so. What was so sad? I asked. I mean, he made it, right? Hugh's voice cracked.
Yes, but he was just so alone. I can't believe you missed it, he said,
as we were going to bed that night. He just pulled his shirt off, and I took a moment to admire his tan. It was nothing he'd worked for. Rather, it just came the result of all the hours he'd spent in the ocean, occasionally with the boys, but mainly on his own, swimming like some sort of creature, one moment on his back, the next in his stomach, turning like a chicken on a spit. He's done this since childhood, and as a result, his shoulders are so broad I can barely get my arms around them. Still, I try. He slips beneath the covers, and I cleave to him like a barnacle, thinking of all the couples I know who no longer share a bed. He snores, the wife will tell me. Or, I need my own space. I'd hate separate rooms, though a sleep apnea machine might be a deal-breaker or incontinence. Definitely incontinence. I can't predict what's waiting for us lurking on the other side of our late middle age, but I know it can't be good. Before returning to England, we drove back to Raleigh and ate lunch with my father, who had a biscuit-sized bandage on his ear and was relying on a walker that had his name and room number written on it in magic marker. I didn't want to meet at Springmoor.
You told us you were Dave Chappelle.
So Lisa and Bob drove him to a cafe that we'd all agreed on. Watching from a distance as he slowly advanced toward the table, I was struck by how breakable he seemed. Still, his spirits were high, and he was engaging, funny even, especially when talking about Springmoor and the way the staff will walk in whenever they feel like it.
It's a problem because I don't always like wearing clothes, and, you know, if you catch my drift.
Sure, I said, thinking. What's wrong with underpants, at least? Kathy met us at the restaurant as well, and midway through our meal, she told my father about the baby loggerheads she'd seen hatching a few days earlier on Emerald Isle.
Oh, right, my father said. They laid their egg there for centuries. For even longer, I imagine. Eons.
And the last one, to pop up out of the sand, she reported. The very last one. The turtle patrol people named Lou. Isn't that something? A more sentimental audience might have moved their hands to their hearts and cooed. Eyes might have misted or filled with actual tears. Had someone named a human baby after my father, called it, say, Lou Sedaris Quitchoff, or better yet, Louis Harry Sedaris Quitchoff, my family might have shared a moment over our salads and sandwiches there at the Belted Goat. But this was an endangered turtle, with only a tiny chance of living until the end of the week. And so it was more like naming a bar of soap after someone, if soap could paddle around briefly.
What I can tell you, my father said, his voice soft and dry, like corn husks being rubbed together. I'm notorious. I'm legendary. I'm a survivor.
And now, from the Annals of Thought section, The Structure of Equality. The philosopher Elizabeth Anderson wants us to rethink the basis of a free and democratic society. By Nathan Heller. American stories trace the sweep of history, but their details are definitely particular. In the summer of 1979, Elizabeth Anderson, then a rising junior at Swarthmore College, got a job as a bookkeeper at a bank in Harvard Square. Every morning, she and the other bookkeepers would process a large stack of bounced checks. Businesses usually had two accounts, one for payroll and the other for costs and supplies. When the company's funds were short, Anderson noticed they would always bounce their payroll checks. It made a cynical kind of sense. A worker who was owed money wouldn't go anywhere or could be replaced, while an unpaid supplier would stop supplying. Still, Anderson found it disturbing that businesses would write employees phony checks, burdening them with bounce fees. It appeared to happen all the time. Midway through the summer, the bank changed its office plan. When Anderson had started, the bookkeepers worked in rows of desks. Coordination was easy. A check that fell under someone else's purview could be handled down the line, and there was conversation throughout the day. Then cubicles were added. That transformation interrupted the workflow, the conversational flow, and most other things about the bookkeeper's days. Their capacities as workers were affected, yet the change had come down from on high. These problems nagged at Anderson that summer and beyond. She had arrived at college as a libertarian who wanted to study economics. In the spirit of liberal arts exploration, though, she enrolled in an introductory philosophy course whose reading list included Karl Marx's 1844 manuscripts concerning worker alienation. Anderson thought that Marx's economic arguments about the declining rate of profit and the labor theory of value fell apart under scrutiny. But she was stirred by his observational writings about the experience of work. Her summer at the bank drove home the fact that systemic behavior inside the workplace was part of the socioeconomic fabric, too. It mattered whether you were the person who got a clear check or a bounce check, whether a hierarchy made it easier or harder for you to excel and advance. Yet economists had no way of factoring those influences into their thinking. As far as they were concerned, a job was a contract, an exchange of labor for money, and if you were unhappy, you left. The nature of the workplace, where most people spent half their lives, was a black box. Anderson grew intellectually restless. Other ideas that were presented as cornerstones of economics, such as rational choice theory, didn't match the range of behaviors that she was seeing in the wild. She liked how philosophy approached big problems that cut across various fields, but she was most excited by methods that she encountered in the history and the philosophy of science. Like philosophers, scientists chased truth, but their theories were understood to be provisional, tools for resolving problems as they appeared, models valuable only to the extent that they explained and predicted what showed in experiments. A Newtonian model of motion had worked beautifully for a long time, but then people noticed bits of unaccountable data, and relativity emerged as a stronger theory. Couldn't disciplines like philosophy work that way too? The bank experience showed how you could be oppressed by hierarchy, working in an environment where you were neither free nor equal. But this implied that freedom and equality were bound together in some way beyond the basic state of being unenslaved, which was an unorthodox notion. Much social thought is rooted in the idea of a conflict between the two. If individuals exercise freedoms, conservatives like to say, some inequalities will naturally result. Those on the left basically agree and thus allow constraints on personal freedom in order to reduce inequality. The philosopher Isaiah Berlin called the opposition between equality and freedom an, quote, intrinsic, irremovable element in human life, end quote. It is our fate as a society, he believed, to haggle toward a balance between them. In this respect, it might seem odd that through history, equality and freedom have arrived together as ideals. What if they weren't opposed, Anderson wondered, but like the sugar phosphate chains in DNA interlaced in a structure that we might not yet understand? What if the way most of us think about the relation between equality and freedom, the very basis for the polarized, intractable political division of this moment, is wrong? At 59, Anderson is the chair of the University of Michigan's Department of Philosophy and a champion of the view that equality and freedom are mutually dependent, enmeshed in changing conditions through time. Working at the intersection of moral and political philosophy, social science, and economics, she has become a leading theorist of democracy and social justice. She has built a case, elaborated across decades, that equality is the basis for a free society. Her work, drawing on real-world problems and information, has helped to redefine the way contemporary philosophy is done, leading what might be called the Michigan School of Thought. Because she brings together ideas from both the left and the right to battle increasing inequality, Anderson may be the philosopher best suited to this awkward moment in American life. She builds a democratic frame for a society in which people come from different places and are predisposed to disagree. One recent autumn morning, Anderson flew from Ann Arbor, where she lives, to Columbus to deliver a lecture at Ohio State University. With a bit of time before her talk, she sat in a high-backed chair and spoke with undergraduates about her work. Almost everyone wants to be respected and esteemed by others. So how can you make that compatible with a society of equals? She asked. The students, looking a touch wary, listened intently and stared. As the students listened, she sketched out the entry-level idea that one basic way to expand equality is by expanding the range of valued fields within a society. Unlike a hard-scrabble peasant community of yore, in which the only skill that anyone cared about might be agricultural prowess, a society with many valued arenas lets individuals who are good at art or storytelling or sports or making people laugh receive a bit of love. Is the idea that we expand the number of values so that everyone gets a piece of the scene? A young woman asked. She was trying to understand how hierarchies of esteem could be compatible with equality. Or is there some sort of respectable limit so we're like, we've sort of found the things we value and you've got to aim for one of them? Anderson replied with a bright crackle of delight. Ha ha ha! And now she cleared her throat noisily and said, if you look back at the origins of liberalism, it starts first with a certain settlement about religious difference, she said. Catholic, Protestants, they're killing each other. Finally, Germany, England, all those places say, we're tired of these people killing each other, so we're going to make a peace settlement. Religious toleration, live and let live. And she spread her hands wider. And then something remarkable happens, she said. People now have the freedom to have cross-cutting identities in different domains. At church, I'm one thing. At work, I'm something else. I'm something else at home or with my friends. The ability not to have an identity that one carries from sphere to sphere, but rather to be able to slip in and adopt whatever values and norms are appropriate while retaining one's identities in other domains, she paused, that is what it is to be free. As a rule, it's easy to complain about inequality, hard to settle on the type of equality we want. Do we want things to be equal where we start in life or where we land? When inequalities arise, what are the knobs that we adjust to get things back on track? Individually, people are unequal in countless ways, and together they join groups that resist blending. How do you build up a society that allows for such variety without turning difference into a constraint? How do you move from a basic model of egalitarian variety, in which everybody gets a crack at being a star at something, to figuring out how to respond to a complex one where people with different allotments of talent and virtue get unequal starts, and often meet with different constraints along the way? In 1999, Anderson published an article in the journal Ethics titled, What is the Point of Equality?, laying out the argument for which she is best known. Quote, if much recent academic work defending equality had been secretly penned by conservatives, she began, opening a grenade in the home trenches, could the results be any more embarrassing for egalitarians? The problem she proposed was that contemporary egalitarian thinkers had grown fixated on distribution, moving resources from lucky-seeming people to unlucky-seeming people, as if trying to spread the luck around. This was a weird and nebulous endeavor. Is an heir who puts his assets into a house in a flood zone and loses it unlucky, or lucky and dumb? Or consider a woman who marries rich, has children, and stays at home to rear them, crucial work for which she gets no wages. If she leaves the marriage to escape domestic abuse and subsequently struggles to support her kids, is that bad luck or an accretion of bad choices? Egalitarians should agree about clear cases of blameless misfortune. The quadriplegic child, the cognitively impaired adult, the teenager born into poverty with chunky parents. But Anderson balked there, too. By categorizing people as lucky or unlucky, she argued, these egalitarians set up a moralizing hierarchy. In the article, she imagined some citizens getting a state check and a bureaucratic letter, which states, to the disabled, your defective native endowments or current disabilities, alas, make your life less worth living than the lives of normal people. To the stupid and untalented, unfortunately, other people don't value what little you have to offer in the system of production. Because of the misfortune that you were born so poorly endowed with talents, we productive ones will make it up to you. We'll let you share in the bounty of what we have produced with our vastly superior and highly valued abilities. To the ugly and socially awkward, maybe you won't be such a loser in love once potential dates see how rich you are now. By letting the lucky class go on reaping the market's chancy rewards while asking others to concede inferior status in order to receive a drip, drip, drip of redistributive aid, these egalitarians were actually entrenching people's status as superior or subordinate. Generations of bleeding heart theorists have been doing the wolf's work in shepherd's dress. In Anderson's view, the way forward was to shift from distributive equality to what she called relational or democratic equality, meeting as equals, regardless of where you were coming from or going to. This was, at heart, an exercise of freedom. The trouble was that many people, picking up on libertarian misconceptions, thought of freedom only in the frame of their own actions. If one person's supposed freedom results in someone else's subjugation, that is not actually a free society in action. It's hierarchy in disguise. To be truly free, in Anderson's assessment, members of society had to be able to function as human beings, requiring food, shelter, medical care, to participate in production, education, fair value pay, entrepreneurial opportunity, to execute their role as citizens, freedom to speak and to vote, and to move through civil society, parks, restaurants, workplaces, markets, and all the rest. Egalitarians should focus policy attention on areas where that order had broken down. Being homeless was an unfree condition by all counts. Thus, it was incumbent on a free society to remedy that problem. A quadriplegic adult was blocked from civil society if buildings weren't required to have ramps. Anderson's democratic model shifted the remit of egalitarian from the idea of equalizing wealth to the idea that people should be equally free, regardless of their differences. A society in which everyone had the same material benefits could still be unequal. In this crucial sense, democratic equality being predicated on equal respect wasn't something you could simply tax into existence. People, not nature, are responsible for turning the natural diversity of human beings into oppressive hierarchies, Anderson wrote. Her first book, Value in Ethics and Economics, appeared in 1987, announcing one of her major projects, Reconciling Value, an Amorphous Ascription of Worth that is Keystone of Ethics and Economics, with Pluralism, the fact that people seem to value things in different ways. Philosophers have often assumed that pluralistic value reflects human fuzziness. We're loose, we're confused, we mix rational thought with sentimental responses. Anderson proposed that, actually, pluralism of value wasn't the fuzz, but the thing itself. She offered an, quote, expressive theory, in her view. Each person's values could be various because they were socially expressed and thus shaped by the range of contexts and relationships at play in life. Instead of positing value as a basic abstract quality across society, the way utility functioned for economists, she saw value as something determined by the details of an individual's history. Like her idea of relational equality, this model resisted the temptation to flatten human variety toward a unifying standard. In doing so, it helped expand the realm of free and reasoned economic choice. Consider a couple who has worked for years to run a family restaurant and is offered a corporate buyout, worth more than they could earn by keeping it open. Traditional economists and many philosophers would say, take the money. That would maximize value. Maybe you can use it to start a new restaurant. In Anderson's expressive model, however, the couple might have a sound reason to refuse. They did not work all those years to make millions for some brand X corporation, she wrote. A concern for the narrative unity of their lives, for what meaning their present choices make of their past actions, could rationally motivate them to turn down the offer. The value of that narrative unity was beyond the reach of the market. For that couple, no price was the right price. In this sense, value in ethics and economics was partly about reclaiming moral authority from the cold-eyed neoclassical economists who guided policy in the 80s and 90s. Anderson's model unseated the premises of rational choice theory, in which individuals invariably make utility-maximizing decisions, occasionally in heartless-seeming ways. It ran with, rather than against, moral intuition. Because values were plural, it was perfectly rational to choose to spend evenings with your family, say, and have guilt toward the people you left in the lurch at work. The theory also pointed out the limits on free market ideologies, such as libertarianism. In ethics, it broke across old factional debates. The core idea has been picked up on by people across quite a range of positions, Peter Railton, one of Anderson's longtime colleagues, said. Kantians and consequentialists alike, people who viewed morality in terms of duties and obligations, and those who measured the morality of actions by their effects in the world, could look at it and see something important. Part of the novelty in Anderson's approach came from a shift in how she practiced philosophy. Traditionally, the discipline is taught through a priori thought. You start with the basic principles and reason forward. Anderson, by contrast, sought to work empirically, using information gathered from the world, identifying problems to be solved, not abstractly, but through the experienced problems of real people. Motherhood coincided with a transformation in Anderson's methods. She started working with historians, trying to hone her understanding of ideas by studying them in the context of their creation. Take Rousseau's apparent support of direct democracy. It's rarely mentioned that at the moment when he made that argument, his hometown of Geneva had been taken over by oligarchs who claimed to represent the public. Pragmatism said that an idea was an instrument, which naturally gave rise to such questions as, an instrument for what, and where, and when. Her approach broadened in other ways, too. In What is the Point of Equality?, Anderson had already started to drift away from what philosophers following Rawls call ideal theory, based on an envision for a perfectly just society. As Anderson began a serious study of race in America, though, she found herself losing faith in that approach entirely. Broadly, there's a culturally right and a culturally left ideal theory for race in society. The rightist version calls for color blindness. Instead of making a fuss about skin and ethnicity, its advocates say society should treat people as people and let the best and the hardest working rise. The leftist theory envisions identity communities. For once, give black people or women or members of other historically oppressed groups the resources and opportunities they need, including, if they want it, civil infrastructure for themselves. In The Imperative of Integration, published in 2010, Anderson tore apart both of these models. Sure, it might be nice to live in a colorblind society, she wrote, but that's nothing like the one that exists. In one study, she cited 60% of people who saw a crime report on TV that hadn't identified the suspect thought that it had. 70% of those people thought that the suspect was black. Other research found that when white people pretended not to notice race, they often acquired alienating tics, such as avoiding eye contact. Color blindness would simply lock in problems past correction. But the case for self-segregation was also weak. Affinity groups provided welcome comfort, yet that wasn't the same as power or equality, Anderson pointed out. And there was a goose and gander problem. Either you let only certain groups self-segregate, certifying their subordinate status, or you also permitted, say, white men to do it, and, well, we have a lot of data from experiments, and they're not encouraging. Anderson's solution was integration, a concept that, especially in progressive circles, had been uncool since the late 60s. Integration by her lights meant mixing on the basis of equality. It was not assimilation. It required adjustments from all groups. Anderson laid out four integrative stages. Formal desegregation, no legal separation. Spatial integration, different people share neighborhoods. Formal social integration, they work together and are one another's bosses. And informal social integration, they become buddies, get married, start families. Black students at integrated high schools, according to one study, had higher graduation rates than those in segregated schools, even controlling for socioeconomic background, parental education, and other factors. Students, black and white, at integrated schools went on to lead more integrated lives. Some philosophers of color welcomed the book. She's taking the need for racial justice seriously, and you could hardly find another white political philosopher over a period of decades doing that, Charles Mills, a philosopher at the CUNY Graduate Center, says. For others, though, a white woman making recommendations on race policy raised questions of perspectives. She was engaging through a mostly white Anglo-American tradition. She worked from the premise that because she drew on folders full of studies, the limits of her own perspective were not constraining. At the same time, in attending to these empirical findings over doctrine, she announced herself as a non-ideal theorist, a philosopher with no end vision of society. The approach recalls E.L. Doctorow's description of driving at night. You can see only as far as the headlights, but you can make the whole trip that way. One of Anderson's premises is that the project of fairness is more shared across a spectrum than many people suppose. Some years ago, she began to envision a comprehensive history of egalitarianism. How did egalitarian ideas emerge and how had they changed? How did they relate to the ideas about the uses and abuses of estate power? Originally, I thought I'd start mid-17th century, she said. But then you realize, well, you can't really deal with that until you deal with the Protestant radicals of the Reformation, like the Anabaptists. But the Anabaptists are harking back to early Christian egalitarian communities, so maybe I have to start looking at, like, the New Testament. Ha, ha, ha. Eventually, Anderson ended up at the hunter-gatherers. It occurred to her that hundreds of thousands of years might be a lot to cover in one book, so she decided that it would be two books or three, possibly five. Regardless, it will take her a while to finish, maybe the rest of her life, but it will be her big project, the unified picture that she leaves behind. Anderson was invited to deliver the Tanner Lectures at Princeton in 2015 and decided to launch the project there. Many people still believe that market economies were a sound foundation of freedom. Yet, she found, 90% of female restaurant workers reported being sexually harassed. Some poultry industry employees were said to have worn diapers for lack of breaks. About 7 million American workers have been compelled to support political positions under threat from their bosses. Such people could not be called free. Anderson zeroed in on Adam Smith, whose The Wealth of Nations, published in 1776, is taken as a keystone of free market ideology. At the time, English labor was subjected to uncompensated apprenticeships, domestic servitude, and some measure of clerical domination. Rigid hierarchies from the king to the pauper were maintained by an arcane system of debts, favors, and gifts. Smith saw the markets as an escape from that order. Their most important function, he explained, was to bring liberty and security to those who had before lived almost in a continual state of war with their neighbors and of servile dependency upon their superiors. Smith, in other words, was an egalitarian. He had written The Wealth of Nations in no small part to be a solution to what we'd now call structural inequality, the intractable compounding privileges of an arbitrary hierarchy. It was a historical irony that a century later, writers such as Marx pointed to the market as a structure of dominion over workers. In truth, Smith and Marx had shared a socioeconomic project. And yet, Marx had not been wrong to trash Smith's ideas because during the time between them, the world around Smith's model had changed, and it was no longer a useful tool. The Industrial Revolution was a cataclysmic event for egalitarians, Anderson explains in Private Government, 2017, a book that she assembled from the Tanner Lectures. She writes, images of free market society that made sense prior to the Industrial Revolution continue to circulate today as ideals, blind to the gross mismatch between the background social assumptions reigning in the 17th century and 18th centuries and today's institutional realities. We are told that our choice is between free markets and state control, when most adults live their working lives under a third thing entirely. Private government. What else could you call the modern workplace where superiors can issue changing orders, control attire, surveil correspondence, demand medical testing, define schedules, and monitor communication such as social media posts? The decisions that a company makes, like the installation of cubicles in the bank in Harvard Square, are presented as none of its employees' business, hence private. Defenders of this state of affairs often counter that people negotiate their salaries and can always leave. Anderson notes that low-level workers can rarely wrangle raises and that real-world constraints eliminate exit power. Workers are sometimes bound by non-compete agreements and usually cannot get unemployment insurance if they quit. It was as if relational equality could be suspended between 9 and 5, a habit that inevitably affects life beyond work. American progressivism is in the midst of a messy reckoning. During the 90s, upper-tail wage inequality, the gap between the middle class and the rich, exceeded lower-tail inequality, the gap between the poor and the middle class. Since then, upper-tail inequality has continued to grow, while lower-tail inequality has remained basically unchanged. The unnaturalness of this top-heavy arrangement, combined with growing evidence of power abuses, has given many people reason to believe that something is fishy about the structure of American equality. Socialist and anarcho-capitalist models are again in vogue. Anderson offers a different corrective path. She thinks it's fine for some people to earn more than others. If you're a brilliant potter and people want to pay you more than the next guy for your pottery, great. If you're just okay but want to work extra industriously for the difference, that's fair too. The problem isn't that talent and income are distributed in unequal parcels. The problem is that Jeff Bezos earns more than $100,000 a minute, while Amazon warehouse employees, many talented and hardworking, have reportedly resorted to urinating in bottles in lieu of a bathroom break. That circumstance reflects some structure of hierarchical oppression. It is a rip in the democratic fabric, and it's increasingly the norm. Andersonism holds that we don't have to give up a market society if we can recognize and correct for its limitations. It may even be our best hope because it's friendlier to pluralism than most alternatives are. And we shouldn't commit ourselves to an ideal system of any sort, whether socialist or libertarian, because a model set in motion like a Swiss watch will become a trap as soon as circumstances change. Instead, we must be flexible. We must be alert and remain alert, and we must solve problems collaboratively in the moment, using society's ears and eyes and the best tools that we can find. Anderson's lecture at Ohio State University was called The Great Reversal: How Neoliberalism Turned the Economic Aspirations of Liberalism Upside Down. A wage and productivity graph appeared on a screen behind her. She had prepared a PowerPoint. You can see that from about 1950 to 1970, the typical American wages kept up with productivity growth, she said. Then, around 1974, she went on, hourly compensation stagnated. American wages have been effectively flat for the past few decades, with the gains of productivity increasingly going to shareholders and to salaries for big bosses. What changed? Anderson rattled off a constellation of factors, from strengthened intellectual property law to winnowed antitrust law. Financialization, deregulation, plummeting taxes on capital alongside rising payroll taxes, privatization, which exchanged modest public sector salaries for CEO paydays. She gazed in the audience and blinked. So now we have to ask, what has been used to justify this rather dramatic shift of labor share of income? She said. Well, the answer, of course, was classical liberal philosophers. Anderson clicked forward to a slide with a pair of unattributed quotations describing the property which every man has in his own labor as the most sacred, inviolable, and championing good conditions for working people. Smith, someone cried. Good. Adam Smith, Anderson said. The classical liberals have been anti-monopolistic. They opposed all forms of free labor, not just slavery, but serfdom, peonage, the unpaid apprenticeship, she said, peering at some undergraduates in the front. While spending the summer researching the history of the Protestant work ethic for her Seeley lectures, Anderson had come across a rarely collected essay by Jeremy Bentham, who was born 25 years after Smith. Bentham is widely known for coming up with the idea for a creepy surveillance prison, the Panopticon, which Michel Foucault much later turned into a metaphor for institutional control. Anderson found that, in this obscure essay, Pauper Management Improvement, particularly by means of an application of the panopticon principle of construction, Bentham had himself proposed that panopticons be used to manage not just criminals, but also the poor, the elderly, and the disabled. Behind Anderson, a slide of Bentham's quasi-mummified body appeared. She grew visibly excited. Pauper Management Improved, I think, is one of the original sources of the arguments for the privatization of public functions, she said. It was no wonder that industrial age thinking was riddled with contradictions. It reflected what Anderson called the plutocratic reversal of classical liberal ideas. Those perversely reversed ideas about freedom were the ones that found a home in the U.S. policy. And, well, here we are. Anderson followed up with an ebullient Q&A and then was taken to the faculty club for dinner. During a lull in the conversation, a professor leaned down the table and said, "So, John Stuart Mill." "Oh," the other philosophers cried in unison as if he'd Z-snapped her in her face. He was a Mill scholar and nitpicking was expected. Anderson laughed. With Mill, she said, it was a mixed bag. He wasn't a complete nut like Bentham, who had been. "Liz, just let me know when you think it's time to go," said the director of the university's ethics center, which had arranged the talk. He'd be driving her back to the hotel. Anderson answered with a sober nod, like Cinderella glancing at the clock, and then, her face brightening, she turned back to the table, filled with strangers who had become friends. Well, we've run out of time again for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it today. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. Today's broadcast and all previous New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.